NRAP Breaking News.
I'm here again with Dr. Ali Raja. He is the Vice Chair of Emergency Medicine at Massachusetts General and a Professor of Emergency Medicine and Radiology. And today we are going to talk about imaging for COVID because things change so fast and what we knew 6 months ago might not be true today, right, Ali?
That's exactly right, Jess. And as you just said, what we know 6 months from now is probably going to be different as well. So I'm excited to talk about this, but with the huge caveat that this podcast is probably going to be out of date in about 6 months. So I hope we get to talk about it again.
I know. I should timestamp this. We are actually recording this at the very end of April 2021. I thought it would be helpful to cover just sort of the imaging basics and then the not so basics. So we could talk about chest x-ray, CT pulmonary angiograms, looking for PEs, when to do that, and then a little bit about ultrasound as well for the diagnosis and workup of COVID. So why don't we start with just the basic test that we pretty much always get on a patient who's short of breath, and that is the standard chest x-ray. I question how helpful a chest x-ray is. Do you feel that way? Because if I'm looking at the patient and they're very dyspneic or they're hypoxic, I don't care really what that chest x-ray looks like. I care a little bit, but I feel like with COVID, sometimes it looks surprisingly not bad and sometimes it looks surprisingly terrible. So help me calibrate. When should I lean on that chest x-ray to help me make a clinical decision?
You are absolutely right, Jess. And the fact is that for a lot of these patients, they don't need a chest x-ray at all. In fact, if they have mild symptoms, then and their SATs look good, you're just going to test them and maybe even send them home before those test results come back, depending on how fast your test results are coming back. And if that's the case, are you really going to get a chest x-ray on somebody who's otherwise stable, likely has COVID, and you're going to be sending them home just because they came in for testing because they had an exposure, for example? So you're right. The fact is that chest x-rays, when we get them, should be helpful. And in patients with really mild disease that you're going to manage as an outpatient from your emergency department, why bother getting them at all? But then you bring up the really great question of when we have patients with a little bit of tachycardia, a little bit of hypoxia, they're a little bit short of breath, should we be getting chest x-rays? Because as you said, the sensitivity and specificity of the chest x-ray is actually pretty variable. When you look at most of the studies that are out there, the sensitivity of chest x-rays is horrible for COVID. We're talking 50 to 60%. And the specificities are even lower, 40 to 50%, because when you do have COVID, it kind of looks like a bunch of other stuff could look on your chest x-ray. So just because it's there doesn't mean that it's specific for COVID. But what we're doing for most patients who we are keeping in the hospital and admitting is we're getting a chest x-ray not for the emergency department diagnosis and management, but because that chest x-ray can be trended over time if the patients worsen. Now, nobody's recommending that we get daily chest x-rays, and we've hopefully moved away from that at most places. But if the patients start to decompensate, it's good to get a second chest x-ray, because if that second chest x-ray looks worse, it can explain what's going on. And if it doesn't look worse, maybe you actually need some further imaging like a CT.
That's a really good point. Patients who have a known diagnosis of COVID, maybe they've been managed as outpatients, and then they come in, maybe they're a week, 10 days into their course, and you get a chest x-ray. Sometimes I've found I pick things up that don't really follow that COVID pattern and it makes me worry about a secondary bacterial pneumonia. But, you know, I think I kind of glazed over something basic here, and that's just to ask you, what is that pattern of COVID that we expect to see on a chest x-ray? What's that look like?
It looks like a lot of other stuff. Now, we've all gotten used to reading this in our reports from our radiology colleagues, but it'll show a multi-lobar bilateral ground glass opacity pattern. So they'll look like these ground glass opacities, but they won't be focal. They'll be multi-lobar, and they'll be on both sides. And predominantly, they can have a peripheral distribution. We'll talk about more about how awesome this is. Well, unfortunate, but how awesome this is later when we talk about ultrasound, because these consolidations end up showing up on the periphery where they're really easy to see by ultrasound. But that's what you end up looking for, is you're not looking for a focal consolidation usually. You're looking for something more generalized.
Now, where I work, we've basically gone to getting a single AP chest film. instead of the standard two-view PA and lateral. And I wanted to ask you, I feel like that's probably a pretty common practice. I wanted to ask what your thoughts were with doing that and some of the pros and cons.
I completely agree. That's what we do where I work as well, and I'm betting that's what happens in most of our shops. If you'll remember, we all remember, this is, as you said, late April. So a year and a couple of months ago, back when we were all starting to see this, when we got chest x-rays and CTs or other imaging for these patients, the radiology suites would be shut down. I don't know how it worked out at Fresno, but here at MGH, I remember after the initial CTs were performed, we used to shut down the scanner for an hour or maybe even longer. I don't remember what it was when we first started, but it settled on about an hour until we got really good at this. And so the same would happen when a patient went over for chest x-ray. They would shut down the chest x-ray room. And so we got into the habit of having them bring over the portable x-ray machine to the patient's room, which meant less exposure for everybody because we weren't moving them down the hall, and also not having to shut down the x-ray room for other patients who might need imaging as well. So we've gotten in the habit of getting these AP chest x-rays instead of the usual PA and lateral chest x-rays. Now, I think we all know that overall, there's some things that we can pick up on the lateral that we might not normally pick up on a PA or AP alone. But quite honestly, the standard right now for patients who have COVID or who are suspected of having COVID and their test results aren't back is just to get that AP view.
I used to like looking at the lateral view. It gives you a little bit of extra information. Most of the time, it doesn't change anything, but sometimes it really does. And I wonder what we're missing. And I don't know if that's something that's known right now or maybe something we'll learn with time. What are we missing by lacking that lateral view?
That's a great question. I think your gestalt, your gut feeling of wanting a second view is right on, right? That's how we all trained. We're emergency physicians and we know that two or three views, especially when we're talking about orthopedic injuries and chest x-rays and other things, are always better than one. So we all have the gut feeling that more imaging is probably better here. And I think that's going to bear out. What we're not going to see a lot of, unfortunately, is a lot of studies looking at this simply because there's not going to be a ton of patients who got both AP and PA and lateral chest x-rays at about the same time. It might be that somebody got an AP x-ray once and then a week later got a PA and lateral, but we're not going to be able to tell if the disease progressed over time or if one imaging study was better than the other. So I'd love to see some data. There might even be some small studies out there, but I don't think we need to hold our breath.
Let's talk about CT of the chest. So there was, when the association was made fairly early on between thromboembolism and COVID, I think all of us, myself included for sure, started doing a lot more CT scans. And I have since walked that way back. But early on, you know, we were looking for PEs. And also there was this bonus of, well, I'll just get the CT scan because then it will tell me if there's a PE, but it will also better characterize what's going on in their lungs. So talk to me about what we know now and when there really is a role for getting a CT pulmonary angiogram or just a CT scan non-contrast of the chest.
So let's take that second one first,
okay,
Jess, if you don't mind. And that's that I think there's very few situations where you're going to end up getting a non-con CT or even a CT chest that's not timed for pulmonary embolism if you're getting a CT on somebody with COVID. And I've had this discussion with a lot of emergency physician and radiology colleagues, and especially given what we know now about the risks or the purported risks of IV contrast, you're already exposing the patient to the radiation. It's all just a matter of timing, and so assuming there's not some true anaphylactic type allergy to the dye, I haven't gotten a non-PECT CT for a patient in whom I'm getting a CT on. And I think that's our general practice at my shop and from all the radiologists and emergency physicians I've had this discussion with. So if you're getting a CT, unless there's a hard stop reason for you not to give that patient IV contrast, just get a PECT. Your first part of the question was a lot more nuanced, and that's, I actually, knowing that you were going to ask me this, I got a little bit of an outside consult. So one of my colleagues here is an emergency physician by the name of Chris Cabral, and if you ever look him up, his name is all over the D-dimer threshold PE literature out there. He and Jeff Klein publish papers all the time. So your question of should we be working these patients up for PE is a really good one, and I think really important. Where I've settled after looking at a bunch of the literature, after talking to Chris Cabral about this, after treating these patients for a year and a half, is that if patients come in and you're getting the D-dimer simply because of the fact that it's part of your admission labs, we all have these admission labs for COVID, you're getting the D-dimer and it comes back elevated, it doesn't necessarily have to trigger a PE workup, except for a couple of cases that I'm going to get. But if you just get a high D-dimer that's elevated, that's 900, 1,000, something like that, and clinically, the patient just looks like they have COVID, meaning they're a little tachypneic, a little hypoxemic. The chest x-ray has some COVID, but it's not very bad, but it's got COVID on it. Then you're done. You don't have to go ahead and chase the CT, or else we'd be getting CTs on every patient that we admitted.
That's right.
Because we know that the D-dimers are all going to be high. The two scenarios where you end up needing to probably chase the CT and get the CT is if the patient is a little symptomatic, a little PE looking, a little tachypneic, hypoxemic, and the chest x-ray looks clean. In that patient, there's really no evidence that says that we can avoid chasing an elevated D-dimer. Because with a clean chest x-ray, they could very well just have a PE. And we don't yet have studies like PERC or like with the Geneva score or the Wells criteria saying that we have a different D-dimer threshold.
Okay, so you're using the same D-dimer threshold, and this would be a patient who does not yet have a COVID test result back yet. You suspect COVID, but hey, the chest x-ray came back, and surprisingly, it looks pretty good.
Right.
We're going down the typical PE path using the typical D-dimer threshold. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And in that case, then this is a patient, especially as we move out of our COVID surges, just like the patients that you might have seen 2 years ago.
Sure.
Then the other scenario where you're probably going to need to chase a chest CT is if the patient comes back with a really high D-dimer. And so Chris was kind enough to send me 6 or 7 different studies that look specifically at D-dimer thresholds, and we were able to kind of really nerd out on this. But when you look at the receiver operating characteristic curves for patients with COVID, and look at where the diagnostic threshold for venous thromboembolism, whether it's PE or DVT, is, it looks like the threshold is about 2,500. Now, that's based on the 6 or 7 studies that have looked at this so far, and I'm sure that'll change over time. But where I'm settling out is, even if the patient has COVID, if their chest x-ray looks like classic COVID, they have a positive test, if they have a D-dimer over 2,500, I'll still get a chest CT.
Okay, so to be clear, this is a good ballpark to start with. It's not yet built into any sort of clinical decision tools that we know of. But just so people have a frame of reference and a rough number in mind, 2,500 is about when you should say, hey, that's just a lot higher than we typically expect with COVID. And we have to start thinking at that point about pulmonary embolism. Is that a good summary?
That's exactly right. And like you said, 6 months from now, there will be different data. There's no clear guidelines about this yet, but that's what I'm using, and that's what some of the other people that I've spoken to are using as well.
So I'm not sure if there's any literature on this, but I feel like what I've seen is that early on in the course of COVID, that's not typically when a patient gets a PE. I don't know the exact time, but I feel like it's not really till they're at least a week, 10 days out. And really, I've seen this later, much later in the patient's course, where they've been admitted, they've been discharged, and now they're returning to the emergency department a couple days later. And sometimes that's when I make the diagnosis of PE. Do we know anything more formal than just my experience, my anecdotes about the timeline of when a PE happens in the course of illness?
We really don't. Your anecdotes are similar to what people have published as well. When you look at the timing of PEs that have been diagnosed, when you look at the diagnosis of PE, it's usually in patients who are a week plus out. What we don't know, though, is when that PE was eventually diagnosed, whether they were an outpatient who simply had have been walking around with COVID and developed a PE, or is it a matter of the, is it a result of the fact that the patient was admitted to the hospital, ended up developing a DVT or a PE while they were lying around in bed, or even worse, in an ICU, despite the prophylaxis that we always give our patients? So yes, you're right. PEs tend to happen later, but that doesn't mean that when a patient presents to you that they couldn't have been having mild symptoms for a few days and so might be in the weak sort of time frame. And even though you're seeing them for the first time, it doesn't mean they don't have a PE, unfortunately.
Right. That's challenging. And hopefully we'll learn more about that as we get more information. I want to ask you also about ultrasound. I know it can be really helpful for making this diagnosis. I have to say, I probably haven't used it as much as I should. You kind of need an ultrasound machine that can just park right back in your COVID area of your emergency department. Otherwise, it needs a really, really thorough cleaning. And I think that's part of the hesitation for me. But could you tell me, what are we going to look for? We do have some videos on MRAP HD that go through how to do a lung ultrasound, but should we be using this, and what findings are consistent with COVID?
We should always be using ultrasound. I think ultrasound is a great tool for so many things, but you hit the nail on the head, Jess. Unless you have a dedicated, and not many of us do anymore, a dedicated pod for COVID in your emergency department, you're going to be spending a lot of time cleaning that ultrasound machine, because it's not like you used it for a trauma, doing a fast, and now you just need to wipe some blood off of it. You potentially had it in a COVID patient's room, and you've got to wipe the heck out of that thing down. I don't even know how detailed the COVID ultrasound cleaning protocols are, but they're very detailed in our shop. Similarly, you can have it in a COVID ICU and clean it, but you know, you'd want to have it in a situation where you are hopefully able to dedicate that ultrasound to an area that is set aside for patients with COVID. But the thing is that ultrasound, because as we talked about earlier, some of the characteristic findings of COVID are peripheral, ultrasound is actually really great for that, because you can see things like irregular or thickened pleural lines or B lines really easily on the periphery. And the place where this is really useful, and again, we can and we should be using this in the emergency department, but that's not where ultrasound is really great. Ultrasound is really great in two places. Number one, it's really great in resource-limited settings. And COVID being the worldwide disease that it is, right now at the end of April, we're in the middle of this horrendous and horrific surge of cases in India. For low-resource settings, ultrasound is really useful for making the diagnosis. The other place where it's really useful is especially in the ICU. There's been some studies that have shown that it's really useful for monitoring recruitment maneuvers as you try to get patients to open up, and also to guide prone positioning. When those consolidations start shifting around, being able to flip patients back and forth, remember those patients, it's really hard to get them down to CT. And so using ultrasound in an ICU to guide recruitment maneuvers, to guide prone positioning, has been postulated as a really useful place for it. And so that's why it's helpful to have our hospitalists and our intensivists learning ultrasound right next to us.
That's really helpful to know, and very interesting about using it for recruitment maneuvers for our colleagues who work up in the ICU as well as the emergency department. I think we could wrap up here. Do you have any other tips, closing thoughts, anything that we have not yet mentioned on the subject of imaging for COVID?
I think my main thought is that we need to all remember that imaging is only useful if it actually changes what we do with the patient. And so using a lot of this imaging on low-risk patients who we're going to send home to isolate, it doesn't do them any good, and quite honestly, it bogs down our emergency department operations. What a lot of people initially in COVID started talking about was using the CT as a screening test, which is just absolutely now gone by the wayside. If you remember, it was useful at the beginning when we were understanding the disease. If you remember that Diamond Princess cruise ship, I looked it up and there was 82 patients who were completely asymptomatic on the cruise ship, and 52%, so 41, 42 patients, had findings of viral pneumonia on chest CT. And that helped us understand that this was really able to be spread like wildfire in a cruise ship type environment. But those were asymptomatic patients who, if they walked in now, there's no way that we would or should get a CT on them. So now that we understand the disease better, if your patient is mildly symptomatic, you're going to be sending them home. They often won't need imaging at all. You're only considering this imaging for patients who are coming into the hospital and then starting with a chest x-ray and then going to the CT for those few situations that we talked about before.
It's so amazing how much we've learned in the last 15 months about this disease and how fast things have changed. So thank you so much for this wonderful overview, and hopefully we'll be able to touch base again in a few months when we have completely new information.
I can't wait to listen to this in 6 months and realize how wrong we actually were.
Hopefully not too wrong.
That's right.
All right. Thanks so much. Remember that we have the COVID-19 chapter in Corpendium, authored by Crystal Ives and Britt Guest, which is updated frequently and peer-reviewed and republished all the time. So that should be your go-to reference on all things COVID. We also have a bunch of examples of the imaging findings that were discussed in this segment.